Hi there. It's time now for your friendly neighborhood economist, the show where you'll hear what's going on with the economy locally, nationally, and internationally, explained to you in plain English. Promise. Welcome to your friendly neighborhood economist, show number 023, wages, fracking, casinos, and power lines, also Turkey, on Tuesday, May 13, 2014. On today's show, I'll be discussing the minimum wage, again, in light of the recent failure of a minimum wage to get through the Senate, and bringing you the first part of my interview with my old friend Yahya Madra of Boğaziçi University in Istanbul on the recent developments in the Turkish economy and their intersection with the Gezi Park uprising. But first, the news. Hudson River Healthcare, a nonprofit healthcare company, has opened a health center in Hudson, and they're accepting new patients at 750 Union Street. The Mental Health Association of Columbia Green Counties is proposing an affordable housing complex off of Joslyn Boulevard. The project before the Greenport Planning Board is to build a two-story, 66-unit building off Green Acres Road. 28 units will be for people with mental health issues, while the rest would be for people who meet the income limit. Columbia County is conducting a survey of broadband internet availability. You can find that on their homepage at columbiacountyny.com. That's all one word, columbiacountyny.com. So go to the website and fill that out. Olana State Historical Grounds has received word that it'll be getting $950,000 in state funding to improve the park. In March, the unemployment rate in the Mid-Hudson and Catskills counties were sharply lower than a year before, according to information released by the State Department of Labor in April. Greene County's jobless rate last month was 7.6% compared to 9.3% in March of 2013, while Columbia County's unemployment rate dropped from 7.1% to 6.2% during the same time. That's the 10th lowest rate reported statewide. Statewide, the unemployment rate last month was 7.3%, down from 8% the previous March. In energy news, both the town of Ghent and the Columbia County government announced that they would be switching to Viridian Energy, a local supplier of electricity generated with solar power. Meanwhile, while everyone has their eyes on these power lines, more on those in a minute, Kinder Morgan Energy Partners, LP, intends to expand its Tennessee gas pipeline through the towns of Chatham, New Lebanon, and Canaan. So watch the news for that. In municipal finance news, which I am assured is the most popular part of this show, several towns and county bodies have passed their budgets for the year. Both Catskill and Kinderhook managed to keep their property tax increases underneath the 2% cap imposed by the budget, meaning folks in those towns, and others I didn't read about, I'm sure, will be getting rebate checks just in time for Election Day. Coincidence, I'm sure. Meanwhile, Moody's is issuing a warning on Columbia County bonds due to uncertainty about what will be done with the Pine Havens nursing home. Is that the same Moody's that gave top ratings to all those toxic mortgage-backed securities in the lead-up to the financial crisis? Oh, it is? Just wondering. The Greene County Legislature is pushing back on the fiscal burden that has been flowing downhill from the federal to the state and finally to the municipal level ever since we all converted to the new tax cuts or bust religion in the 1980s. They would like the state to pay for things the state says must be done, such as Medicaid coverage. Meanwhile, Lafarge has finalized its deal to buy the old Holcim cement plant and has broken ground on a new facility. Here's a fun fact. Did you know that cement manufacturing is one of the leading industrial contributors to greenhouse gas emissions and global warming? It is. It looks like our area will not be getting a casino because of lack of infrastructure, i.e., there's no highway through the middle of Catskill to the point. I never thought that I would be happy about a lack of infrastructure, but there it is. On to power line news. There have been some developments in the power line saga over the last month, naturally. First, apparently responding to public pressure, Governor Cuomo said that plans that use existing right-of-ways would be given priority. That existing right-of-way language means that additional land would not be taken from landowners in the path of the power line expansion in those cases where plans were submitted using them. This was always a possibility anyway, but the governor added this little incentive of prioritizing plans that had this feature. Of course, these newly prioritized plans could still have very objectionable features as well. In response to this announcement, National Grid announced it would take eminent domain off the table, meaning that its plans will use existing rights of way. National Grid is representing New York Transco, which is one of the four companies trying to get the contract to build new power lines through the Hudson Valley. Sounds good, but Farmers and Families for Livingston and Farmers and Families for Claverack would like a little more. Specifically, the cost-benefit analysis showing that the project is actually necessary, the reason why taxpayers should pay extra to repair and upgrade the system when utilities already collect money for that from our bills, an engineering report with cost estimates for underground and new high composite cables that can increase capacity in existing tower space, and a commitment from the governor and the Public Service Commission that the profits of utilities will not trump the three growing economic sectors of the Hudson Valley: tourism, food, and real estate. That's from their newsletter, and good questions that should be answered before they start putting up giant towers all up and down the valley. Similar concerns are being raised in Athens about the proposed high-voltage DC lines that the West Point project wants to run underneath the town's main street. In two separate meetings on April 23rd, residents voiced concerns and asked questions of the state's Public Service Commission representatives Heather Benke and Jeremy Flaum, and Vice President of Planning for the Fairfield, Connecticut-based private investment firm PowerBridge LLC, the West Point project's parent company, Chris Hucker. I'll have an interview next time with some of the Athens residents, but for now, here's a clip from the recorded public comments recorded by Sam Sebrin, WGXC program volunteer and Athens resident, as well as member of the Athens Citizens Development Committee.
In my eyes, it's a bomb. Our fire department, the Department of Works, even trained utility workers like myself are not ever going to be ready for it. The amount of noise and work hours for the project, the route they want to take, the health concerns, the dangers, all of it's for what? To lessen the risk of brownouts downstate. I think it's a horrible plan. I think it's rushed. And I'm almost ashamed that I'm here speaking at this meeting because our public officials, both town and village, think it's an option.
The West Point Partners Project will set a precedent for merchant industrial use and erode the character and quality of life of these historic areas. These types of projects should be sited solely in industrial quarters.
Finally, the project should not move forward at all unless a clear need is demonstrated in the context of numerous other transmission projects.
This is just one more project. How many more will there be? The people who come to visit have respect for what we have here. It's time that New York State and the Public Service Commission did too.
The impact on fire, police, and ambulance response time, it's huge concern. Mutual aid from nearby fire companies such as West Athens and others will be delayed. This evening, we're meeting at the E.J. Arthur Elementary School. I'm actually thinking how difficult it would be for many people here this evening to get here in a timely manner if Leeds Athens Road was closed.
Disruption of traffic into the village is going to severely affect these businesses. You don't even have to be an expert to know that. The parking of the equipment, construction equipment, on the streets at night is going to create an eyesore. No one is going to be able to sell their house. No one's going to want to come and open a business.
Now the West Point project is requesting to set aside the zoning ordinances and plans for the land use plan for the Village of Athens so that they can do pretty much as they please as far as locating the structure. I don't think that is appropriate for us.
The gas line that Central Hudson is putting in does have some benefits to the people in the Village of Athens. The power line that West Point Partners wants to put in provides no benefits to the Village of Athens, but it has many negatives.
You know, the sheer number of waivers being requested should be a warning sign. The justification for each is basically the same. If we don't get this waiver, it will add time and cost to the project, and the local laws are just too subjective. If working within the law makes this project incredibly time-consuming and expensive, then it should be incredibly time-consuming and expensive. Personally, I hope it's prohibitively time-consuming and expensive.
How can the impact of that converter station be mitigated at all? That land was zoned that way for the very purpose of keeping things like this from being built. And zoning laws created by residents that live in Athens should not be waived by state agencies.
That was Eddie Grant with Electric Avenue. See what I did there? Now for state news. Speaking of casinos, only 22 bids were delivered in time for the deadline last month. Perhaps the $1 million application fee had something to do with that. The closest bids are in for Howe Caverns in Albany locations, as well as some in Sullivan County. Guess we won't be seeing many of the low-wage jobs or the headaches associated with casinos in our area. In budget news, the governor has added funding for solar power this year, committing $1 billion to increase solar power generation to 3 gigawatts, or about 3 watts per dollar, in new generation capacity. You may remember that the government wanted the tax cap in his budget to increase the combination of functions across town lines. Well, a report shows that 30 school districts have considered merging in New York over the past decades, with most deciding against it because apparently the pesky voters in those towns refuse to approve the mergers. Starve them out, governor. It's the only way. On the plus side, the governor has created a commission to study how best to spend the $2 billion to upgrade technology in New York schools and build pre-K facilities to enable universal pre-K for New York children. On the other hand, the state approved $128 million for storm preparation. This is just the tiny first down payment on adaptation to climate change, which is totally not happening, and if it were happening, would totally not be our fault. And even if it were, it would be too expensive to prevent. This political propaganda has been brought to you by American Petroleum Enterprises, or APES. Speaking of fracking, two stories involving this practice in the last month caught my eye. First, the New York State Health Department, for completely legit reasons, I'm sure, was not interested in participating in a national study on the health impacts of fracking. It would have been very helpful, especially if the state turns out not to allow fracking, because it would have made the fracking in neighboring Pennsylvania a natural experiment, with New York as the control. This would have been very helpful in cutting through uninformed debate about health impacts, but it won't be happening. I leave you to ponder why the state wouldn't want that as a homework assignment. Meanwhile, just to make sure we don't miss out on any health impacts of fracking, a Senate committee shot down a ban on importing fracking waste into New York from the aforementioned PA. State Senator Celia Katchik was the bill's sponsor. Way to go, Senator. Better luck next time, I guess. Finally, in health news, the state enrolled almost 1 million people in health plans under the exchange set up under the Affordable Care Act. Nothing left to do now but hunker down and wait for the predicted apocalypse to happen.
With so much drama in the LBC, it's kind of hard being Snoop the old double G. But I, somehow, some way, keep coming up with funky ass sh- like every single day. May I kick a little something for the G's and make a few ends as I breeze through 2 a.m. and the party's still jumping cause the mama ain't home. They got bitches in the living room getting it on and they ain't leaving till 6 a.m. So what you wanna do, sh-? I got a pocket full of rubbers and my homeboys do too. So turn off the lights and close the doors.
But what?
We don't love them hoes.
Yeah.
So we go smoke an ounce to this. G's up, hoes down while you motherfucker bounce to this. Rolling down the street, smoking and go sipping on gin and juice. Laid back with my mind on my money and my money on my mind.
That was news anchor Brian Williams inexplicably rapping the song Gin and Juice. Who knew he was that laid back? Seriously, though, this is not the first cover of Gin and Juice I've used on this show, and I hope it won't be the last. In national news, just a quick little note about employment for this month to leave room for my rant about the minimum wage increase that wasn't. There were some big jobs numbers reported this past month, 288,000 new jobs, but no movement in wages and a big decrease in the unemployment rate that was due almost entirely to people leaving the labor force. Not all great news, really. The drop-off in labor force participation, that's those people leaving the labor force, is, I think, in no small part due to the fact that extended unemployment benefits were not renewed by the Senate. So anyone holding out hope that they might still be able to collect must have given up by now. The benefits could have increased the unemployment figures, since you have to be looking for work to be considered unemployed and to collect unemployment insurance. So there's that. On to more gloomy news, the federal minimum wage. First, a few words from a familiar voice, Martin Luther King Jr.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor. So often we overlook the worth and the significance of those who are not in professional jobs, of those who are not in the so-called big jobs. But let me say to you tonight, that whenever you are engaged in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
There's a philosophical discussion underway in America about the minimum wage. Some people, like financial commentator Peter Schiff, think increasing it could have devastating effects.
There's a law in economics, supply and demand. It's something that you learn in Econ 101. And as you increase the price of something, you decrease the demand. And wages, you know, that's the price of labor. The higher you make the minimum wage, the more jobs are going to be destroyed.
I mean, you care about the poor.
Of course I do.
Yeah.
I just acknowledge that government programs are trapping them in poverty.
Why have one job for $15 an hour when you could have two jobs for $7.50 an hour?
What would you rather do that or pay twice as much for your burger?
I do like to taste the tears of poverty in my milkshakes.
I couldn't wait to discuss these economic theories with real-world fast food workers protesting for higher wages.
If we raise the minimum wage, you know, eventually the market is going to adjust to that, and then everybody is going to lose purchasing power.
We cannot survive on the bare minimum.
If we could just keep this out of the personal realm.
All these fast food workers looking at things through their personal experience goggles.
I found it so hard to explain those kinds of complex economic theories to those desperate people.
I mean, do you ever go into a McDonald's or Burger King? I mean, I don't really eat there, but they don't seem desperate and hungry to me. They're young kids. They seem to be enjoying themselves most of the time.
Those irrepressible teens with their teen hijinks.
That's right. These protesters are just teens having a goof.
I mean, what are you complaining about? This is fun for you. You're a teenager just making some funny money to throw around and party with.
I actually have five siblings, younger siblings that I have to support.
This was getting harder than I thought.
Hypothetically, how would you tell a 48-year-old man with a bachelor's degree who works full-time in fast food that he is not entitled to a living wage?
You're creating a hypothetical situation that's not going to exist.
I'm 48 years.
You're 48 and you're still in high school?
I have a bachelor's degree. And I end up working there because I was out of job and couldn't find a job at the time due to the economy.
Putting a face to the people on supply and demand graphs is really confusing. Thank goodness the economic theories on how the minimum wage destroys jobs are ironclad. Author and equities analyst Barry Ritholtz.
There are a number of studies that have come out that show increasing the minimum wage actually improves the economy.
Shut the f- up.
If we raise people up just $11 so they're at the poverty level, they'll go out and they'll spend that money on food and medicine.
Sure, that sounds good, except for one simple thing.
People don't go hungry in a capitalist economy. It's socialism that creates scarcity, that creates famine. In a free market, there's plenty of food for everybody, especially the poor.
And the fact that people in our economy aren't hungry is all the proof you need that free market capitalism is the answer.
Lots of people working full-time for profitable companies like Walmart and McDonald's need food stamps and welfare because they can't afford to feed their kids. McDonald's and Walmart are the biggest welfare queens out there.
What?
They're taking advantage of the safety net in order to capture more profits and lower their costs.
As it turns out, the fast food industry alone costs taxpayers roughly $7 billion a year in public assistance to their employees. It's practically McWalmart's cyst. But for many, when it comes to our economy, it's our country's founding principles that matter.
If we eliminated the minimum wage law, then individuals would be free to accept jobs at whatever pay they're able to get.
Paint me a picture of a person whose work would be worth $2 an hour.
You know somebody who might be? Maybe somebody who is, what's the politically correct word, mentally retarded. What's the new...
Okay.
That's what I believe in the principles that the country was founded on.
But...
I'm not going to say that we're all that created equal. You're worth what you're worth.
You're worth what you're worth.
Just like our founding fathers said, you're worth what you're worth, and we're not all created equal.
Poor Peter Schiff, who went on to follow that interview up with some serious whining about his being treated unfairly by that sneaky Samantha Bee. This guy makes a fortune, but maybe he's not really worth it if a comedian can outsmart him. Now, as Barry Ritholtz says in the clip, there are a ton of studies out there that have looked at the question of what the economic impacts of increasing the minimum wage actually are, never mind the libertarian utopia that Peter Schiff apparently lives in. There's no conclusive evidence that it costs jobs. There's mixed evidence that it promotes growth. There is the undeniable fact that many people who are now working and poor would be lifted up a little, though not a lot, it has to be said, if we could raise the minimum wage to what it was in 1968, when you factor inflation in. There was, of course, a proposal to do just that in the Senate this past month, and let's see, what happened to that? That's right. The U.S. Senate, composed almost entirely of millionaires, could not seem to pass that bill, because only 54 senators were in favor of even bringing it up for debate. 54 out of 100, shouldn't that help things? Anyway, you may have heard that the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, studied the possible impact of the bill. You may have heard that they discovered it would be a job killer, all caps, if you're playing along at home. In fact, in their summary, they said their best guess was about 500,000 lost jobs overall. They didn't analyze how much of this would be people going from two jobs to one or from three jobs to two, and they didn't analyze the full-time equivalent employment changes. Clearly, though, people who lost jobs because of this would lose income for as long as it took them to find another job, which would then be at a higher wage. Just saying. The CBO also said that there would be a $2 billion increase in real income overall, which would also move 900,000 people above the poverty line. Real income would decrease for those families above six times the poverty line by 0.4%. Everybody below would see an increase in their real income. Now that 0.4% is a total of $17 billion. That's less than one half of one penny on the dollar for those people. The total cost and higher prices for you and me and everyone else? About 10 cents a day. So that sounds horrible, doesn't it? This bill would also have fixed a couple of other things about the current minimum wage. First, it would have indexed the minimum wage to inflation, so that if Congress sits on its hands, as it so often does, time alone would not degrade the buying power of the minimum wage. That's why, although in 1968, the real value of the minimum wage was about 10-something, now it's much lower. This would at least guarantee that a full-time, full-year minimum wage job would get a family of two out of poverty. Not a family of three, mind you, but a family of two, yes. The second important fix would have been the minimum wage for tipped workers that remains at $2.13 per hour. That's right, folks, $2.13 per hour. Thanks to the National Restaurant Association, the other NRA, or Big Burger, Congress has maintained the low minimum wage for tipped workers in restaurants. Few people think they are paying the wage of a server when they leave a tip, but that's what they're doing for a lot of workers, mostly women. So those two changes alone would have made a huge difference for the people at the bottom of the economic ladder in the U.S. Across the country, fortunately, states and cities are not waiting for the Congress to act. Would you? Seattle has taken the step of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour over time, although the details of the implementation of this change are not sounding all that great. Some Democratic New York City lawmakers are pushing for a $15 per hour minimum wage for businesses with yearly sales of $50 million or more in the city. Of course, a survey of small New York State businesses found that a majority favor a 10-10 minimum wage. A majority already pay their workers more than $10 per hour, so they favor a more level playing field with big box retailers that pay the minimum, for one thing. Minnesota has raised its minimum wage to $9.50 an hour. Meanwhile, Connecticut, Maryland, and now Hawaii have increased their minimum wages to $10.10 an hour. Hawaii also voted to raise the minimum wage for tipped workers, making less than $17.10 an hour with tips. So they would now make at least $10.10 an hour without tips. All this is for the good, with the so-called recovering continuing to grind out mostly low-wage jobs. So $10.10 for the win. That's for all you New Yorkers out there.
A favela nunca foi reduto de marginal. A favela nunca foi reduto de marginal. Ela só tem gente humilde marginalizada, e essa verdade não sai no jornal. A favela é um problema social. A favela é um problema social. Sim, mas eu sou favela, posso falar de cadeira. Minha gente é trabalhadeira e nunca teve assistência social. É, mas só vive lá, porque para o pobre não tem outro jeito. Apenas só tem o direito a um salário de fome e uma vida normal. A favela é um problema social. A favela é um problema social. A favela nunca foi reduto de marginal. A favela nunca foi reduto de marginal. Ela só tem gente humilde marginalizada. E essa verdade não sai no jornal. A favela é um problema social. A favela é um problema social. Sim, mas eu sou favela e posso falar de cadeira. Minha gente é trabalhadeira e nunca teve assistência social. É, mas só vive lá, porque para o pobre não tem outro jeito. Apenas só tem o direito a um salário de fome e uma vida normal. A favela é um problema social. A favela é um problema social. A favela é um problema social. A favela é um problema social.
That was Seu Jorge with Eu Sou Favela. Now here's the first part of my interview with Yahya Madra, assistant professor of economics at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, a member of the editorial board of Rethinking Marxism, and one of the people behind the new economics website, Building Economy. I'll have a link to that on my show notes after the show.
So I'm here today with Yahya Madra, associate professor at Boğaziçi University. Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, and on the editorial board of Rethinking Marxism, a journal of Marxist thought. Welcome, Yahya.
Welcome, Tom. How are you?
Good, good. It's good to see you virtually. Just to let you all know, Yahya and I started grad school together those many years ago, 2 decades ago now. Hard to believe. We both had much more hair at the time, but it's good to see you, hair or not. Okay, so why don't you start by giving us kind of the outline of the development of the economy in Turkey over the last 20, 30 years or so, especially the last 10 or 12 years or so since Erdogan's been in power.
Yes, I mean, perhaps there are some sort of breaking points in Turkish history, and most important of these perhaps is 1960 coup and then 1980 coup. Of course, there's another coup in 1971, but 1960 and 1980 are kind of, economically speaking, transformational moments. Very briefly on 1960 is actually what is known in for many argue that it's kind of a left-wing coup, even though that's an oxymoron, of course. But in the period, the youth and the military, hand in hand, there was this kind of, it's part of the Arab socialist sort of spirit, Arab nationalist later on, but that spirit of sort of military coup. One important aspect of that coup was that it enabled a lot of laws regarding the unions, a lot of laws regarding welfare state. It kind of established a Keynesian developmentalism as the institutional framework, Keynesian developmentalism. And that continued for 2 decades, and in 1980, just prior to the coup in September 12, In 24th of January, there was a number of IMF there was an IMF agreement with a number of important stipulations. So in 1980, and that was the sort of beginning of structural adjustment programs and kind of beginning of neoliberalism in Turkey. It didn't properly begin until 1983 when this guy called Turgut Özal, sort of important prime minister of Turkey, came into power. And throughout the 80s, we observed a number of liberalizations, a trade liberalization, financial liberalization, and initial sort of start of privatizations. Of course, Turkey throughout the century, Republican years, is a kind of a very strong state-led economy. And as I said, the Keynesian developmentalism didn't even actually bolster that sort of. So there was a lot to sell, and there is a lot of resistance, of course, to those sales as well. Mm-hmm. So 1990s perhaps was this sort of protracted neoliberalization period, but also sort of probably more importantly marked by a major civil war that between Kurds and who are demanding autonomy and the Kurdish liberation movement and the Turkish state. One thing that is really important for actually understanding the 2000s is the fact that throughout the 90s, forced migrations, forced displacements, internally displaced populations of Kurdish towns into big urban sort of centers like Istanbul, Izmir, Ankara, some say amounts to 1.5 million, and add to that the economic migration, which is constantly happening. So there is a major proletarianization and a major industrial reserve army that is emerged out of the 1990s in the urban areas. So this civil war was very brutal, and it went for a long while, until Öcalan, the leader, was captured, and then there was a kind of a lull, and then in 2000s, that lull kind of benefited perhaps AKP's initial years. Only later on there was a revitalization of the movement, and now again there's a peace process. I'll touch upon what's happening there later on, perhaps their economic models, etc., the autonomy that they want. But the main thing I would like to say is that 2000 kind of is now we have a major urbanization, major dislocation of industrial reserve army into the urban sort of periphery. And also, again, another layer of sort of demographic shift in terms of agricultural subsidies being lifted to a large extent, which pushes. So that's probably one of the most important aspects of the 2000s. That's like a huge labor market. Another aspect of 2000s is, of course, how it started. It started with a major financial crisis. The government throughout the 1990s had huge sort of debt, public debt, and it was indebted not only to foreign sort of capital, but also to internal sort of true bonds, very high rate bonds. This financial crisis in 2000 actually led to a major restructuring of the finance system through figure of social democratic left in Turkey, but actually worked for World Bank, Kemal Dervish, who came in to actually go through the financial restructuring in 2000 after the financial crisis. In fact, some regulations that happened during that period are still more advanced than the ones that are happening in the United States after 2008 crisis.
Actual regulation, then.
Yes. There are issues still, I think, but it was much more rigorous, and it actually created a sound financial system in certain ways, which actually enabled Turkish economy to continue throughout the 2008 crisis with a, if you like, a a year of bad sort of lack of growth, but then again it resumed pretty quickly, and we can talk about that as well. So part of the reason was that it's actually institutionally it is somewhat what the capital wants, finance capital wants in many ways. Right. Maybe not too much profit, but it's secure, especially in a time of crisis.
So
the second aspect, therefore, is this sort of financial sort of reform. And this financial reform, of course, is what enabled Turkey to finance its growing sort of trade deficit. So Turkey is actually sort of has a systemic structure in its sort of trade, sort of foreign trade. Every time we observe an increase in its exports, we observe an increase in its imports as well. And the reason for this, if we look at the data, most of the imports are intermediary goods and raw materials. So we have, on the one hand, of course, energy. On the other hand, we have a lot of sort of intermediary goods that are required to assemble the parts and then produce. So a lot of the sort of industries are based on assembling and then selling, both internally and sort of for domestic markets, but also exporting to other destinations. Talking about the peace process, one of the most important destinations in the Middle East is northern Iraqi Kurdish regional autonomous in the northern Iraq, all right, you know, sort of, or southern Kurdistan. Mm-hmm. So Turkey is growing pretty steadily, not 3.5 times as our finance minister once said, looking at the nominal numbers, but actually around 40-60% over the last decade, cumulatively speaking. And then it's a pretty sort of in real terms, that is in dollars. And in real terms, it's actually a sustained growth except the crisis year. And what we observe in the crisis year in relation to current account deficit is that the moment the flow of funds stops, the growth stops. Mm-hmm. So the growth is very dependent on two things. One is that it can sell the stuff to Europe, which is one of the most important overall sort of export destinations, and as I said, Iraq as well, but North Southern Kurdistan and Middle East as well, but the more important part is Europe. And the second is that this is actually financed, this sort of growth is financed through the availability of credit. So once that stopped, as it did in 2007 after the crisis, the growth also collapsed, and unemployment, which is around hovering around 10%, jumped to 15%. So, and then it resumed back slowly to 10% again. Well, one thing that could be sort of said about this structure is that this sort of, if you like, a kind of a foreign capital dependent growth and a growth with trade deficit and growth with domestic market oriented production, which of course means that people are going to be more indebted as well, because the one of the ways that this sort of credit this gets distributed is through sort of credit cards and sort of consumption credits, like small-scale consumption credits. And even some stories of micro-level analysis shows that even microcredit is sometimes used not for production, but actually paying up some of the consumption-related, durable goods-related debt, for instance. So what this does is, of course, in a way, it creates a kind of a I don't want to say totally fictitious economy, because I want to be careful as the post-Keynesian. This is actually how the economy grows. So, and in partly, this is the reason why I wanted to have this conversation, because in Turkey, we observe, on the one hand, quite sort of significant neoliberal institutions being implemented, but also some quite Keynesian ideas also being sort of deployed in different ways. Of course, Keynesianism could be, if you like, progressive, or could be more sort of conservative as well, but in terms of its nature. But it's actually a challenge for me to make sense of it as well. In a way, it's an interesting combination.
Right.
I'm continuing. Do you want to step in or?
No, I mean, I guess one question I had about Turkey's trade balance was about energy. So you said a lot of the export market for a considerable part of the export market for you know, the final goods that the Turkish economy produces is northern Iraq or the Kurdish autonomous region, which has a lot of oil. So is oil coming back the other way from that part of Iraq, or do you get your energy elsewhere? Are there significant you know, internal sources of oil? I know from my own breathing experience that there's a significant amount of cheap, dirty coal that's found its way to Ankara and other places, especially around election time. Yeah, talk a little more about energy.
I don't have the exact, two things. I think the oil trade is happening. There's actually two things there. Of course, the oil trade is happening with northern Iraq or Kurdish autonomous region, but legally, but also illegally as well. That at least it used to happen. That's a very interesting little story there. But I'm not so sure what the composition is, so I don't want to actually say anything about that. But internally, the energy issue is, of course, a very, very contested issue. And the reason why it's contested is that, first of all, we don't have enough oil, so that needs to be purchased. And then we don't have natural gas, so that needs to be purchased from Russia. So that comes from Russia that I know. We have coal and a very dirty coal, that's true, and those coal industries were one of the places, not surprisingly, where the resistance to neoliberalism was quite hard in the 90s, so working class movement happened there in terms of resistance privatization, but that became privatized. The other areas are water, hydroelectric, the power. Of course, there is wind, and then there is also the question of nuclear, right? Solar is there as well, but solar is very limited. Wind is big, so that's sort of emerging as a sort of a small area. But the most contested area is the hydroelectric power plants that are being kind of these micro power plants that are being built in beautiful lush valleys of sort of northern Turkey and in of course in southern Turkey and in Kurdistan where it's within Turkish borders. So in a way, this is actually creating a lot of environmentalist movements, which are not necessarily going from Istanbul to these areas, but also locals themselves actually uprising, right? So it's not an implanted movement, but actually a very authentic indigenous sort of resistance to these, because it kind of puts the water into pipes, basically, right? Sort of, the rivers are kind of totally sort of damaged. So the question is that how much of the electricity these power plants, hydroelectric power plants, will actually supply? Their life term is very low, so that's not a major source and a solution. In fact, their costs are much higher, environmental costs, but these are going through. Part of the reason, as we will mention, is due to it's part of the construction industry.
Right.
It's actually a lot of sort of investment that's happening. And there are two nuclear plants that are being built, still contested very much. One in Sinop, which is a beautiful town in northern part of Turkey on the Black Sea. It's actually a U.S. base was there, a prison, very historically important prison, like with a lot of intellectuals been there in the past. And it's a fishing town, beautiful, beautiful town, and they're building up a nuclear plant there just on the shore near the town. And then there's another one in the Mediterranean coast in Mersin, which is actually a more industrialized town, but again, this is in a part where that's, again, beautiful in terms of environment. So these two, one is built by Russians and the other built by, if I'm not mistaken, Japan. So there are two sorts of nuclear plants that are being built. And so these are kind of also very contested areas of, mm-hmm. because social movements are very much questioning this. Greenpeace and other social movements are questioning this.
And when I think of Turkey, I frequently think of earthquakes as well. So are these particularly non-earthquake prone areas that they're building in? Or?
Well, that I don't know. That's a good question. Almost entirety of Turkey is pretty earthquake prone. Mm-hmm. In terms of the risks, of course, for instance, there is one very, very problematic nuclear plant just in Armenia across from the borders.
Yeah.
And that area is also very prone to earthquakes as well. And this is actually a very dangerous one. So we have one in Bulgaria as well. So there's this sort of number of others which are already in existence. Mm. One, not that we should add to these, but I don't sort of that risk is, you're very right, is already very much with us, even there's no one in actual Turkish borders. Sinop, I think, might be a more sort of a secure place in terms of earthquakes. I don't, historically, I don't remember much of earthquakes in that Black Sea region. But Mersin could be the one in the sort of southern part of Turkey might be pro. But the earthquake connection is, of course, links to urban transformation, which is a different, which links to the construction business aspect of the political economy. So the energy is actually a major contestation area. To wrap up, I think it's actually a kind of both a nodal point for sort of most important, sort of it's a nodal point, one for the trade, foreign trade, it's a nodal point for ecological conflicts, it's a nodal point for, in terms of the understanding of the sort of growth as a kind of construction-based sort of path, it's a source of employment, the construction of these, so it's actually bringing together various things. It's a very strategic ministry for Erdogan's government. So as the Ministry of Urbanization and Environment. So it's like this combined together environment and urbanization ministry. So so that's actually building the construction on housing projects and all that. If you look at the sort of Turkish political economy in the last decade, what we observe is sort of very secure financial system institutionally, which is creating a kind of portal to attract capital. Growth that is based on this capital inflow, which is used towards paying the energy cost, the intermediate good cost, and which is used for, in terms of perhaps building up housing stock and building up a major construction industry, right? It's like sort of 10% employment within actual narrowly defined construction, but if you think about the peripheral, it's a larger sort of sector. And with new sort of infrastructural investments that are in line, that is coming up in the next couple of years, that will continue at a different scale, right? You know, sort of, because we have now a big airport being built, a new bridge on Bosphorus, and a whole highway system around that, so another highway system, a third one to Istanbul, which of course means that there will be urbanization in those areas around the sort of exit and entries of those highways. Actually what Erdogan calls Canal Istanbul, Channel Istanbul, which is actually another Bosphorus, a second Bosphorus to the west of Istanbul, because Istanbul has grown to that side, so creating another sort of like a Panama Canal type of setup, so that the ships would go through there, but then it would create a whole sort of coastal housing as well along the line as well. So it's kind of a crazy project, he calls it, and it's a sort of a project which is very contested by Russia because it's going to drain Black Sea, they say. So I'm not so sure if it is feasible.
Well, that's all we have time for this month. Next month, Yahya Madra tells us a bit more about the protest movement in Turkey and its relationship to the economic developments he's been talking about. We'll also hear more about the West Point project from some folks who were at the public meetings in Athens in April. And I'll start talking about Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, which I'm reading either next show or the one after. We'll see what I can squeeze in. Until next month, this is your friendly neighborhood economist, out. This has been your friendly neighborhood economist. I can be heard on the second Tuesday of every month or anytime online. Check me out on WGXC.org, on Facebook, just search for your friendly neighborhood economist, on my Tumblr blog, yfneconomist.tumblr.com, or on Twitter at yfneconomist. If you've got a question you've been dying to ask a sympathetic economist, send it to me through one of those venues or email me at yfneconomist@gmail.com. Please send in your questions and suggestions. I'd love to incorporate them into the show. Until next time, bye-bye. Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist is a production of WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre Catskill Hudson, and Thomas Masterson.